horses. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable, the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces is now open and in session. God save the United States of America in this honorable court. Please be seated.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome to this special session of the United States Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces here at Hampton University, otherwise known as Judge Johnson's alma mater. We're very pleased to have all of you here today, and we are very grateful to President Williams and the First Lady for hosting us here today. So thank you very much, General and Mrs. Williams. We have one case this morning, United States versus Green Watson. Judge Sparks regrettably cannot be here this morning. He will be participating fully on the record. Major Bruhan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the public?
Yes, Your Honor.
And Colonel Tom, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes, Your Honor.
Very well. Please proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, members of the court, and may it please the court. I am Major Bruhan, along with my co-counsel, Ms. Megan Marinos. We represent Senior Airman Jaquan Green Watson, the appellant in this case. Chief Judge Olson, with your permission, I would like to reserve 3 minutes in rebuttal.
Grant.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Air Force Court erred for two reasons. First, it affirmed the military judge's 404B decision for a purpose the military judge explicitly said he was not going to consider for. And second, because this evidence should not come in for that purpose. Turning to point number one, the military judge explicitly stated in his ruling that he would not consider this evidence of the February 6th incident as to Aaron Green Watson's intent from 17 months earlier during the charged offense. Yet, the Air Force Court states in their decision that it's at least implicit that the military judge considered it for. 404B has a list of specific reasons where propensity evidence may come in under an exception. They are each independent reasons. That's not to say it couldn't come in for more than one, but when looking at the plain text of 404B, it uses the word or, indicating each of these are different. Similarly, as the court in St. Martin, which is referenced in the Brandon case, says, each exception is carefully carved out of the general rule to serve a limited judicial and prosecutorial purpose. So the common scheme of plan doesn't equal intent. They can be used together, but they're not the same. So when the military—
in your view, does this case really center on the fact that, in your view, the military judge said he would not consider it for the same reason that the Court of Criminal Appeals said it would? Or do you have a broader view that if a judge did not explicitly say that, it still would not be permissible for CCA to consider different grounds than that specifically cited by the military judge?
Aaron Green Watson's position is both, Your Honor. Because 404B says that propensity can come in for a limited purpose, it's for that specific purpose. So if the military judge doesn't state that that's what it can come in for, and that's the fact that you're considering it for, a CCA can't come in and rubber stamp it by adding another reason under 404B, which is different than FESS, because in FESS, it's about a military judge's decision to exclude or to deny a discovery request.
Now, is that based on the wording of the statute alone, or are there due process, fairness concerns, or concerns about the extent to which a CCA could rely upon the subsequent 403 analysis that was conducted by the military judge?
To your first question, Your Honor, there are due process issues, because when the CCA said, oh no, they meant intent, the defense at the trial level, they weren't. Their theory, their defense wasn't defending against the idea that it was going to intent, so that is a due process issue. As to the 403 balancing, the Air Force Court here said that the military judge didn't actually conduct the 404 balancing test. They acknowledged that. The military judge quoted the rule, so they did the analysis themselves. While that can be appropriate to the 403 balancing, it's not appropriate This was said in Wilson that longitude for ballots is binary. So when the Air Force Court didn't assess the fact that the military judge didn't articulate what the fact of consequence was being more or less probable, we had failed in balance there. They wouldn't have met the court of rebalancing if they did a proper analysis of Article 66. But they didn't.
Looking at the military judge's opinion, the military judge was responding to four arguments that trial counsel had made. And very early on in that opinion, the military judge says the government offers several non-propensity bases for admissibility of the evidence. That is relevant to accused consciousness of guilt, his intent, his common plan, plan control, MGW. And then the military judge goes through each of those four arguments, and the military judge, although he just used the word intent, seems to be distinguishing intent from common plan or scheme. And just wondering, although the military judge says I'm not going to use this word intent or can't show intent, did he mean any kind of intent that the government planned to? Because that's just being not predicted by the rest of the military just said.
It is not very good, Donna. He does say that any common or common scheme or plan, but the way that he describes it is seen later. He says that it's distinguishable from propensity, but then he goes on to describe how the government is going to use it and how it's allowed it. He says that the government seeks to draw parallels between the specifics of the accused behaviors when he's frustrated and angry. When you hold that up to the rule, or 4B1, the prohibited uses, it mirrors the prohibited use. That you can't, it's not admissible to prove a person's character in order to show that on one occasion he acted a certain way, and yet the same character can act in this way. That's literally what the judge is saying it can be used for. So he says on the same plan, but doesn't conduct a proper analysis for how could he even come into that person. And your point is excellent, Your Honor, because when it comes to common plan or scheme, usually we're looking at the type of intent that's deliberative. It's premeditated, like conspiracy or forgery or fraud schemes. Even child sexual abuse, where there's grooming along the way, that's the type of intent we're looking at here.
That's a very rational approach, I think, for these issues. But is that really what our cases in Munoz and Johnson and Reynolds, is that really a fair reading of those cases? Because they don't seem to dictate that kind of, this sort of distinction between a premeditated plan, a much more specific, concrete, premeditated plan to engage in misbehavior, and more of what is, I think, more fairly called the propensity to engage in that kind of behavior. So where do we get from those precedents, or do we have to distinguish those precedents to get a narrower view of common scheme and plan that you're suggesting?
That articulation is actually in San Martin, where they actually describe and talk about the difference between intent or common, those types of things versus the split second intent that's formed, for instance, in this case, the threat. But we can look at the precedent, Your Honor, because here we have one instance, 17-month gap, and another instance. There's nothing happening in between. There's not regular threats. There's not regular any of those things that are happening. Whereas in those cases you mentioned, Your Honor, there's a variety of different instances that are happening, and it's happening in the same way. So this case can be distinguished in that way, but it's also not like more, like Melissa just cited to, which I know is not present in this court, but there, when they're looking at a scheme to control, it's 2.5 year period where the controlling behavior is happening the entire time, and the two instances of alleged sexual assault are in between. So it's regularly controlling what she eats, when she works out, who she talks to, how she spends her time and money. That wasn't testified in this case. We have one incident, a 17-month gap, and another incident, which is the way the judge described it, being used to show propensity, and that's how the government argues it in its closing argument as well, saying that he acted this way this time, so you know he acted this way during the charge process. Why was that important for the government? Because her credibility was such a big issue. She had lied to the police, she recanted, idea of charged offenses. The government needed to bring this in order to bolster credibility later.
Counsel, on that point, the government's argument, didn't the government specifically say that it was relevant to wrongfulness in their argument?
They used the word wrongfulness once in their 17-page, well, as always to the February 6th incident, they say wrongfulness at the very end. But when they're describing how they're using it, they're talking about him controlling her, and we know that he did this because she told you later that he did it, and so we know that he has this history of controlling her, and then they do move it, and then they say the word wrongfulness plus.
But counsel, isn't that what the CCU that they essentially conflated the manipulative behavior with the wrongfulness prong to prove up the wrongfulness prong of the intent? So they said there was manipulative behavior. It was evidence of a common plan or scheme. And so all the military judges' findings did not use the word wrongfulness. The CCA, that's what the CCA hung its hat on, saying implicitly he was proving the fact of consequence. So it was your position that no, that was incorrect.
My position is that it was incorrect for them to assert a new rationale for letting the evidence in, then the judge explicitly said it wasn't going to be served. Best, the military judge didn't say, oh, this reason is why I'm not, I don't agree with this reason for denying discovery, I agree with this other reason. The CCA there just found that new reason and said, okay, well, that's the correct result. But that's not the best, too. It's the correct result. This wasn't the correct result. The CCA should have announced analyze whether the military judge shot the guns and conducted the analysis correctly. Instead, they inserted a different rationale, which is not appropriate. So Amory Monson was robbed of his right to a proper analysis from the CCA level. When we're looking at the intent here, the military judge did appreciate that it would be improper to look at intent. We know that because when he says he's not going to use it, he references the fact that he doesn't find any of these facts to relate this February 6th incident occurring after the charged incident to Aaron Greenwald's intent at the time of the charged offenses. He appreciates that was not appropriate. So the CCA coming in and saying, no, this is how it could have been appropriate. Well, that's then identifying that the military judge didn't see what fact of consequence was made more or less probable. So they didn't know that. Just not appropriate. Especially in 404B cases where evidence can only come in for limited permitted purpose.
Counsel, what would we make of the fact that the military judge said more than once is not going to look at it for propensity purposes? If the military judge said that, how can we conclude that the military judge did the opposite?
Well, Your Honor, this isn't where the judge is silent. He says he's not going to consider it for propensity, but then he demonstrates for the CCA and for this court that he doesn't appreciate what propensity means. He says that the government's going to draw parallels between specific behaviors here and specific behaviors on charge of crime, which he is saying a person's character and they acted on charge occasion in line with the way they acted on another particular occasion, which is propensity.
But then how do you distinguish that from the elements that are needed for common plans and similarity?
So the military judge said that he found that there was some similarity, which we know from this court's decision in Hawaii, we're all looking at the similarity. But what the judge failed to articulate is this gap in time. So if we're looking at a common scheme plan and we're looking at those types of cases, you also have to look at the gaps in time, whether there's any intervening circumstances or lack of intervening circumstances. You look at the number of instances that it occurs on and whether the commonalities are similar enough or just general and superficial, which they were in this case, especially given the gap in time and no evidence that anything else was happening, which again is different than the Moore case. and even Bergman, which had to do with assaults that were close in time. There were many cases where they're talking about a common scheme of plan, and the concern is about those gaps in time. So many of them are allowed in because of the closeness in time. And that when there are gaps, while Judge Hardy, they're not saying, oh, the intent here, those are the types of cases where they're saying, well, they acted in the same way, and if it's separated by 7 years, let's say, when it's scheme or plan, and it's about forgery, and there are so many different steps along the way that one has to do in order to effectuate a scheme or plan like forgery, or a conspiracy plan where there's discussions and meeting of the minds, it makes sense in those cases where you can have a bigger gap of time because of the type of intent we're
dealing with. But here, in this situation, the sense of government's argument is not incremental, but solid. And that the episodes of Dorado last 17 months, but that the similarities were sufficient enough to be able to come to a common point of scheme. So how do you address that distinction between, because what you just described were the incremental.
So episodic in and of itself, in that word, implies that it's not planned and it's not a scene. It's happened here and it happened here. It's exactly what happened. And there's always a concern. Military judges are supposed to be on guard against the wolf of propensity that comes dressed up and shoots clothing. That's exactly what happened here. One instance here, when we're looking at the words that are said, that it's not a plan to control or manipulate her. It's the intent needed for a threat in that moment was happening. It's quickly and spontaneously formed. That's what happened. So then when we look at 17 months later, and another argument happens, it's the same type of thing, but it's not linked together the way a common scheme plan would be. And while they don't use the words, well, that's the type of intent. That's what they're looking at in those types of cases, where it's multiple different points in time, where there's a thought process of the accused thinking about why they're doing something. Or like in forgery, where there's multiple steps that have the pressure to create cause of crime. Here, we have an argument, and a heated argument, and we have another heated argument. They're not connected. Coming to prejudice, we know that the government has a burden of proving that it didn't impact the claims. But what we have here is that both charges rested on MGW separately, so not guilty of the one where the 404B evidence wasn't being argued for. He was not guilty of the one that it was being argued for, showing that it did have an impact. Yes, the government. Your Honor, I see your time is about to expire. Evidence of later in time and extent should not have come in under 404B. The Air Force Court's decision affirming that evidence was error, given the 17-month gap between the charge and later in time incident, the lack of intervening circumstances, there are only two separate independent incidents, and the general or superficial commonalities. The incident should not have come in as a common scheme of plan or intent, given the type of intent here is quickly and spontaneously formed.
Thank you, Major Bruna. Colonel Tell.
May it please the Court, I'm Colonel Anthony Talcott, along with my co-counsel at the time of the Washington representing the United States Air Force, will be asking this Court to affirm the lower court's decision. The military judge in this case did not abuse his discretion when he made a reasonable determination that the accused scheme to control his wife through threats would be relevant in evaluating the threat in this case. As a starting point, it's important to recall 404B evidence is a rule of inclusion, not exclusion, and that it can be permitted for any purpose so long as it's not prohibited use. The prohibited use is explained in 404B, sometimes the short would be called simply propensity evidence, and the military judge in this case was emphatic that he was not using for propensity. At paragraph 6 of the rule, he describes correctly what the prohibited tomorrow, paragraph 23, he distinguishes planned evidence from propensity and explains how they're distinct. And paragraph 24, he explicitly states, not for reasons prohibited by 404A or for propensity purpose. And paragraph 31, he reiterates. The military judge was in fact that he was not using his evidence for any prohibited purpose, and this court should decline the invitation to assume the military judge not only did so, but essentially was dishonest or mistaken in his own ruling. Turning to his determination and the scheme, where in fact the evidence did amount to a scheme or a plan, this court is very clear what issue we should be looking at is there substantial similarities between these two episodes.
Counselor? 25 years ago, this court said in Morrison that the uncharged acts had to be, this language, almost identical.
Yes, sir.
And I don't think we've used that phrase, at least in the majority opinion, since then. Is that still the standard? Have we ever overruled that? Have we ever overruled or distinguished Morrison?
No, Your Honor, the court has not overruled that language from Morrison. I do think, though, that in I urge the court to read the Morrison decision quite closely. I think when the court's saying that language, the reason it's not cited again is it's referring to modest supporting day evidence, which that's a very specific type of plan evidence or scheme evidence used to prove identity. And this would be a good moment to disagree with this point of appellate defense to suggest that the 404B purposes are all independent or mutually exclusive. They are not. In fact, many of them completely overlap, or I would describe sort of like Russian nesting dolls. For example, it's hard to imagine planned evidence that does not include an intent. Plan necessarily implies intent, or preparation evidence that does not imply a plan. You can't really prepare unless you're going to have a plan. And that's simply what the Air Force Court said when they were reviewing the judge's decision. And what the judge assumes, everyone would assume when they read it, is ruling. How can you plan to accomplish something on accident? In addition, looking at the judge's rulings, he uses the language we're familiar with for finding intents. He says the plan or scheme was to control, to manipulate, to deter, to prevent. That's the phrasing. A to is a preposition followed by a verb to show a specific intent. To kill, to permanently deprive, to gratify a sexual desire. He's speaking in the language lawyers understand to mean specific intent in his ruling. This court should not assume he did that accidentally.
But Counselor, what are we to make of his specific sentence about he did not use intent? From the later time event, in February 22, to show intent for the earlier event?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the judge asked, he was not making points, he's asking questions, but he highlighted exactly where I would go, which is, I think it's important this court be entirely fair to the military judge and not seize upon language he's used. But I'm specifically referring to paragraph 21. He considers consciousness of guilt and the intent that would be that would go with consciousness of guilt. And then he shifts to paragraph 22 to specifically discuss plan and scheme. So when he says, I don't find evidence of intent, he's talking in terms of the consciousness of guilt discussion. So what the government argued was, we think Pellet was abusing his wife in the February incident to deter her or to intimidate her for testifying against him. And the judge says, I find no evidence of that. I don't find that there's any connection there. And similarly, I don't find that it reflects his intent. He moves on and considers something totally different, which is, was he using these threats to deter, to prevent, to manipulate her, and to not report it to the authorities 17 months previous on the charge incident? And with regard to that, he of course does not have his intent. It doesn't actually say it. I think he's hoping the court will understand the word plan implies an intent. And it's no surprise the Air Force Court actually uses the word. We think implicitly he was talking about intent because he absolutely was.
Counsel, I don't know if you're interested, but when I read our precedents, especially the older ones, Ingalls, Johnson, Reynolds, I'm having a hard time figuring out where the plan and scheme ends and just raw propensity evidence begins, right? It seems like, well, he has a plan to control and abuse his wife. Sounds an awful lot like he's the kind of jerk who beats up and controls his wife. And one is propensity evidence, and one is apparently a common plan or scheme. And that's what our precedents say. But how do we know when we're crossing that line from common plan and scheme to just what is really just comments on the accused character?
Yes, Your Honor. I think the beginning and the end of that is to the number and the weight and the importance of the substantial similarities that are the facts between the two incidents that make them substantially similar, so that you're moving further away from just basic character evidence. So typically the court thinks in terms of character evidence, character for violence, character for law abiding, character for truthfulness, where in this case, for example, is when he's in an argument with his wife in his home about the child care, he's going to threaten her in a way that makes her think her child is in danger, and he's going to then call the police randomly. Those, that number of specific facts that are echoed in both scenes, both episodes, moves it from not being propensity, but to a very specific sort of thing. And as the court's aware, that is way more similarities than this court precedent typically require, like in Munoz, Johnson, Reynolds, for example. But those cases also have a number of similarities. Like they're very close in age. You know, Munoz, 8, 9 years old, the court put great weight, but it wasn't like preteen versus prepubescent. I think the court gives great weight in finding not a planner scheme to distinguish McDonald's, where the accused was molesting, when he was 13 years old, molesting a 6-year-old. The court's like, that's very different than a grown man, 33-year-old, molesting his daughter. They said, that's not a punishment. That's just character. What you're saying is a bad person molesting people because they weren't substantially similar. So it's the number of actions that stack up. And this is a good point, I think, to highlight to the court that this court's precedence in the area of domestic violence perhaps hadn't highlighted the importance of substantial similarity. This is a case where that could be the opportunity. And the reason I highlight this is to look at the federal district court and certain courts of appeals opinions discussing domestic violence. They highlight in these cases, because these people interact so closely together, the 404B evidence would very often be relevant for some purpose to explain their relationship, their history, their purposes, their motivations, their common grounds. Like in this case, it appears the pump is extremely angry whenever his wife asks him to watch their child. That seems to be something that really fires him up, because in both situations, those are common. In this case, for some reason, the trial judge and the Air Force Corps did not seem to recognize the significance that this was a domestic violence case, which necessarily took with them a number of substantial similarities. The same victim, the same child, the same home, the same marriage, the same relationship. It emphasizes the dimension of this. And those are significant looking at federal circuit courts of appeals decisions in evaluating whether or not 404B evidence would be admissible to show intent or plan or scheme.
Now, on this point about the type of offense we're talking about, the time happens kind of, some of our older precedents, like Lynch and Johnson, came out of child abuse cases. And now those are sort of better dealt with, or more specifically dealt with the MRV 513 and 514, which I don't think existed in those cases were handed down. Do we need to reevaluate, or would it be wise for this court to reevaluate how we determine something as a common player scheme? Because those cases were based on fact patterns when you often have large gaps of time between when the offenses occur and when they're reported, you're dealing with children. They're sort of different, and I think the president recognized that when he created 513 and 514. Are those cases still, or should we really evaluate how we think about those cases and the precedent that comes out of those cases, given the change to the military rules of evidence since then?
Your Honor, candidly, it is peculiar. I started this research with the first class where I'm reading all these cases that are planned scheme evidence, and I'm like, why wasn't this just 414 evidence or 415? And I realized that it wouldn't exist. So the tests are different. But I think the court's test that announced at Pimple, which is post 413 and 414, is entirely workable. And that's substantial similarity. And Pimple is a very persuasive case in helping to analyze this case. In fact, the defense raised any of the identical arguments they're trying again to raise in this court. In fact, turning to Pimple on page 167, the defense counsel's argument was basically, well, the judge said it's for plan or scheme, but that's not an element. What did they use it for? And the court basically says, well, what do you think they used it for? It was intent. Intent was the issue in the case. And plan or scheme shows intent, just like this court should do, again, in this case, as it did in Pimple. And going back to one of the questions Judge Max had or highlighted, defense counsel at trial and the judge at trial knew it was going to be used for intent. You can see that from the closing arguments made by trial counsel in this case. When they were addressing the issue of the February incident, the 404B, they said, this Anderson knows what happened in February. He's trying to control his life with threats as part of the scheme. So the government not only uses exactly the permissible purpose, they understood what it was for. The defense counsel didn't object and said, well, wait a minute, Your Honor, you said you weren't going to be superintendent, because everyone in the court knew a plan implies intent. And of course they were going to argue for intent. There's only three elements in this particular crime, similar to the one. He made the threat was heard, and it was wrongful. It's had an evil state of mind. What else was he going to use it for? The threat is for court. There was no dispute about whether he made the threat or the threat was heard. So of course it was here.
Can we move on to 403? One of the arguments that Elmer seems to be making is this is had a very and risk is that this was great. The instance of the uncharged misconduct in many ways is much worse than the charged misconduct. And we had a tape of the charged misconduct, and the facts were, if not wholly self-explanatory, I think they were. The question is, what was the additional motive value? Even if we agree that it shows the con plan or scheme, how did that outweigh the risk as possible for this?
Yes, Your Honor. I think I have two answers, but I don't want to get lost here. I'm making both. The first is we disagree in the later incident was more severe. In both of them, he threatened to kill her. In both of them, he's putting the child in danger. In the earlier incident, he shaking the baby by the head, shaking the baby by the legs. These are both very egregious. I don't think either is substantially worse than the others. I just disagree with the defense counsel's initial premise. Now, with regard to the probative value, perhaps being relatively low, given the strength of the government's case and the threat was reported, I think Judge's question suggests an excellent point, which is the government's case was very strong. So the probative value was not overwhelming. I mean, to be completely candid, it's very clear he's guilty of making a threat against his wife, and the evidence was strong. The danger of unfair prejudice has to substantially outweigh that probative value. And here, given that it's a military judge alone case, that danger was exceedingly low. It certainly didn't substantially outweigh it, especially when the judge was so careful and emphatic about how he wasn't going to misuse it, only use it for permissible purposes. In addition, when we look at the government's closing arguments, he was only arguing for permissible purposes. And I will say, although there isn't really much of a credible dispute, the disputes that were there and the points that the defense was trying to make did go directly to the accused state of mind of lawfulness. They suggest that this is just the way they talk. They have a tumultuous relationship. This is how he treats her. So the only issue really needs to be was lawfulness to that extent was probative. It's not like it was de minimis probative. It was probative on the issue that was a dispute, and it certainly was substantially outweighed by the danger of the prejudice. Turning to one of the points that defense counsel made, which was the gap is 17 months. I mean, just highlight the 17-month gap for 404B evidence is actually relatively short in this court's case law. And not to suggest that gaps in time are relevant, gaps in time are relevant. In fact, courts should, because gap in time, think to themselves, were there significant circumstances that changed in that intervening time that made the scheme not match? But make this seem different. In this case, there were none. It's the same marriage, it's the same couple, it's the same fight, it's the same home, it's the same dispute, it's the same small baby. No significant circumstance changes between these two incidents. Juxtaposed against cases like the Knox, which I already referenced, where it was the last time his sister, fast forward 20 years, it's the last time his daughter, he's grown up, he's become an adult, he's become a man, he's married, he's had a family. Those are the significant circumstances that intervene and make you think this is not part of the same scheme or plan. I'd also highlight that the order of the events matters less if we're talking about episodic scheme evidence. That is, I think it comes outside of the case, like in the Munoz case, where Munoz accused was alleged to have molested his two daughters, older daughter, and then 12 years earlier, his younger daughter. Both of them molested around the age of 39. Now, as it happens, the younger daughter came forward first, so the evidence he molested the older daughter was prior to and admitted for that purpose to show a scheme or plan. But logically, relevance doesn't matter the order in which the daughters were born. Of course, if the older daughter had quoted the verse. It said, "My daughter, my father molested me when I was 8 or 9 because he was molesting. And I have evidence of that, which is after he molested me, he did the same thing to my sister." That never revealed the scene. So the order of this matters, the last thing we talked about, episodic evidence of scene. And I'll highlight, although not exactly what we not even really discussed at all in the Hippolyte decision, the Hippolyte decision is also evidence of subsequent acts of prior 404B evidence. The military judge in that case permitted specifications 1, 2, and 3 to be used to show a common scheme of plan for 4 and 5, and importantly, vice versa. And that's sustained over 2 years. Now, candidly, in overcoming to the court, this court did not address that or highlight it was a subsequent acts case where they give much weight to the 2 year gap there. That is in this court's precedent. And I think the reason it doesn't get much discussion is it's relatively obvious. If it truly is a scene, it doesn't matter what the order of the events were, so long as there's no one who intervenes with us.
Colonel Townsend, I'd like to pull back from the specifics and ask you for your opinion in regard to a more general legal function. If a trial judge says, "I am admitting it, this evidence for X reason," and the Court of Appeals says it was properly admissible for Y reason, can the Court of Appeals essentially save the case in terms of determining that although the trial judge was incorrect for the grounds, he said it, or she said it, it was admissible for a different reason under 404?
Yes, but sometimes no. Let me explain what I mean by that, Your Honor. So in this case, I know you want it to be general. The court is aware of it, sometimes called the Tixie Coachman Doctrine, that is, the court could affirm a lower court, so long as there is some rational reason to affirm the judge for his decision. This case, this court, this decision, the permanent sort of cemented Tixie Coachman Doctrine works. The problem could be, if the judge, as it was in this case, is a fact finder, so we know he didn't use it for that purpose, that could become more problematic. Or if the judge is distracted, you can only use it for this purpose, so we know the fact finder did use it for that other purpose. Then it could become more problematic.
I'm not sure I get your point. So if the military judge admits it for X purpose, and the CCA says that no, that's not correct grounds, why would it? Wouldn't the trial judge be instructing the panel to consider the evidence for an improper purpose?
I think that's what I was saying in our early judge. That is the situation where it could matter, where either the judge is a fact finder and we know because he said he did it wrong or he did it wrong, or he instructed the members to do it wrong, so we know he did it or he did it wrong. So I would agree with you, Your Honor, if that were our case. That could be problematic, but that is not our case.
So, again, broader legal principle. To what extent can the appellate court rely upon the trial judge's 403 analysis if, in fact, the trial judge was viewing it through improper ground in 403?
Well, again, obviously, respectfully, I don't think that's this case. The court should carefully look at the military judge's ruling. So, typically, for what would be danger and unfair prejudice comes in two folds. You have to answer the question. One, the judge would use it for propensity purpose, and the other is perhaps, as it has been said, that the evidence is so egregious, it sort of inflames the judge's passion, so he's not ruling that he's rational. In a case where it's a military judge alone, where he says he's not using it for propensity, he certainly would presume he was impassioned or inflamed. I think the risk is relatively low. But the court should look to the judge's ruling and behavior to see if there evidence is passion or inflamed or that he did use it for a propensity purpose. But as it is in this case, there's certainly no evidence of that. In fact, military judge found that he was guilty of the charge.
Any further questions from the bench? Saying not, thank you.
Thank you, Your
Honor. Ms. Bruin, you have reserved time for 3 minutes.
Thank you. you must be carefully balanced. The military judge just quoted the rule. It's not like in Wilson where the judge had an admirably detailed written analysis. That did not exist here. And the government cites to the gaps in time not mattering, but in Alper, one of the cases they cited to, the court says rarely will an event that occurred subsequent to a charged crime be probative of intent. They let it in because there was only a one gap in time. We had 17 months here. And the dissent in that case says, warned on that point as well, says that evidence that an accused committed the very crime for which he's charged on a different, uncharged occasion prejudices the defense to the highest order. Unquestionably, it has a powerful and prejudicial impact, and that's exactly why the government seeks to use it. To your point, Judge Mathis, that's exactly why they wanted to use it, because it was prejudicial. Which brings me to my third point. The government's case was not strong. They did have recording, but in that recording, you heard two married people angry, fighting, arguing back and forth, and after Aaron Remonts made the words that were communicated, that were charged, his wife is angry, standing her ground, not acting as though she's being controlled, and she says, this is my house. My name is on this house. This is my house. So what if I want to come back? It's fine. I'll tell them what the F you did to me.
I just want to ask you the same question. Do you have a view on what the correct standard is for how similar uncharged acts have to be to the charged acts for them to establish a common scheme of crime?
And Aaron Watson's position, Your Honor, is that it should be, as this court has said in Morrison, almost identical.
And is that standard consistent with the court's decision in Hippolyte?
The dissent in Hippolyte warned against that and said that it strayed far from the almost identical requirement. Hippolyte is distinguishable from my case too, Your Honor, because it's five instances over a two-year period of time. Here we have two independent instances separated by almost the same amount of time.
But going back to Morrison, that the almost identical, most of those cases do relate to modus separandi, and many of them related to proving identity, whereas that's not an issue in this case. So how we or should we distinguish Morrison from the statute scenario? Modus operandi was not an issue, identity was an issue.
My understanding is that Morris did talk about motive and intent, and they said that it wasn't an issue, and essentially that what was trying to be brought in was essentially that there was an unnatural sexual desire for girls, and that is propensity. So I think it can be distinguished here because essentially it's saying that on this occasion he acted one way and on the earlier charge occasion he acted the same way. And because he has the potential to blow up at her, then that means it's more likely that he blew up at her here, which was important to the government because she had serious credibility issues. And the one charge that they argued this for the evidence for is the only one who's not guilty.
Yeah, absolutely.
The very first point contests the government's suggestion that they didn't fall into a law of primary evidence. And your argument is that they had actually initiated the search strategically. What is the relevance of the reason that they brought it? I think I also missed that, misunderstood that, I'm not sure why it happened.
It matters, Your Honor, in the court. Diaz stated that essentially the prosecution can't create an act and an argument by the defense and then say, oh, we're using it to rebut it in order to bring in uncharged acts. Here, the government noticed a month before trial that they wanted to bring this in, and the defense opposed it. The judge decided before trial that it would come in. So it's not accurate to say that they were just using it to rebut. They brought it in the case in chief, and the defense knew that it was coming in for this reason and had to adapt its theory around that. And unlike Wilson and Hippolyte, the evidence wouldn't have come in absent this ruling. So, and while her credibility was an issue, her recanting wasn't tied to the later time incident, so it wouldn't have even come in to rebut that either, because the reason she recanted was immediately after. It existed existed well before the Court of Appeals.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Bruhan.
Thank you.
The case is now submitted. The court thanks counsel for both sides, and the court will stand adjourned until further order of the court.
Correct. All rise. Court is now adjourned until further order of the court. Please be seated.
So at this time, we are no longer sitting as a court. What you have up here are four judges, three of whom are also law professors, one of whom is the former acting dean of the law school. So I hope you will take advantage of that fact. We'd like to have you ask any questions you may have about the court.